So last week, I guess it was in second service, so I'll have to tell you what happened. In second service, at one point, Jamie Leonard commented that, wow, just, boy, good message to hear, but whew, I can't wait for next week when we get into some of the good news after all the, you know, all the wrath of God. And I didn't have the heart to tell him that we still have another week. We're not quite there yet. Yeah, you know, and there's a real lesson in this. I mean, Paul takes a lot of time to make sure that we understand this bit. And like I kind of intimated in one of the sermons, I think 2 weeks ago, we, deceptive, tricky little five-year-olds that we are in our hearts, we try to move very quickly through this in our experience, right? We're happy to think about it and say, oh, yes, I believe in the sinfulness of mankind, blah, 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 blah. But in our own experience, we want to just kind of say, okay, yeah, God, I'm a sinner, I confess it all, boom, and then just get right on to the good news. And it does not work that way. The limit, the extent at which you really experience in your life the reality of what Paul's talking about in these first three chapters will be the very hard brick wall limit to how much you can experience of what he's going to talk about in 5 through 8. So, anyway, let's move on. So far in Romans, Paul has been describing the problem that the good news solves. And, you know, for the very reason that I just laid out, this is, you can't skip over it. The problem is that humanity is under the wrath of God. And we are under the wrath of God for refusing to acknowledge him, refusing to submit to him, accepting our role as the image of God, and then, as just the natural result of that decision, filling the good world that he loves and the people of that good world that he loves with lies, with violence, and with filth. And in turn, Paul has moved through these concentric circles, addressing the Gentile world at large, addressing the moral person who thinks that he's an exception to what Paul said about the world at large, and then finally, last, as we looked at last week, addressing the Jewish individual who would have, in his point of view, every reason to think that belonging to God's covenant exempts him from the whole picture. And in today's passage, Paul first, we're actually kind of taking two passages. In the first one, 3:1-8, Paul's going to address two possible misunderstandings of what he's said about the Jew being under God's wrath. Okay? And then from 9-20, he wraps up his whole argument about the sinfulness of mankind, and particularly the fact that the Jew is also under God's wrath, with a series of quotes from the Old Testament. So this is Romans 3:1-20. What advantage then is there in being a Jew? Remember, because he's just argued that the covenant's not going to protect the Jew from the wrath of God. Or what value is there in circumcision? Much in every way. First of all, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. What if some did not have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? Not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? I'm using a human argument. Certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not say, as we are being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result. Their condemnation is deserved. What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? Not at all. we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away, they have become together worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves, their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips, their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood, ruin and misery mark their ways, and the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. The word of God for the people of God. So, as I said, in verses 1 through 8, kind of the first section here, Paul's building on what he already said back in the second half of chapter 2. And you probably remember that there, in that second half of chapter 2, Paul argued that the Jew is just as liable to punishment as the immoral Gentiles that they look down on. Because even though he has the promises of God's covenant, he does not obey the commands of God's covenant. Paul said that since the Jew actually falls into the same sorts of sins as the Gentile, he should expect the same punishment. Now here, having made that point, Paul voices two possible objections to what he said. Both of them are things that Paul was incorrectly reported to teach. We remember that we see in Acts that when Paul would show up, people would say, oh, here's this guy who's turning the whole world upside down. Paul was already very well known, and his reputation preceded him. But very often, it was a slaughtered version of what he said, the same way that we see people do in all places and all ages, taking an opponent and constructing some ridiculous argument that they don't actually make in order to then disprove this. You guys, you know what I'm talking about, straw man argument, right? So Paul is using this opportunity, remember we talked about this at the very beginning, to show the churches in Rome that the horrible things that they have heard about him are untrue, and that he actually preaches the same gospel that they have held and received, and they can, with good conscience, support him in his proposed mission to Spain. So he's continuing the argumentation concerning the Jew being under the wrath of God, but he's also making sure he works in points that he wants to set straight with them. So the first objection is in verses 1 through 4, and kind of paraphrasing what Paul says here, verse 1, we hear the voice of that objector. So Paul, at a national level there, if the Jew is also under the wrath of God, is there no difference between Jews and Gentiles? And Paul responds, there's a huge difference. The Jews have the promises of God's covenant. And then we have the voice of the objector again in verse 3. But if Israel is unfaithful to the covenant, doesn't that mean that the covenant is broken? And if the covenant is broken, and God doesn't fulfill his promises, doesn't that make God unfaithful? The point here that's kind of that Paul's putting in the voice of this objector is that some said that Paul taught that the covenant was broken, that God was done with Israel, and that there was no longer any difference at all between Israel and any other people. That the Jews were no longer the people of God. Okay? And we see that in the book of Acts, people making that accusation against Paul. And so here, Paul puts this takes this argument, right, and puts it in somebody else's voice so that he can then answer it. And in verse 4, he says, absolutely not. He says, even when every other person is unfaithful, God is still faithful. He says that God will keep all his promises, even if Israel doesn't keep any of their end of the bargain. Even though some individual Jews, perhaps even many, will fall under the wrath of God, in the end, God will turn everything around and fulfill his promises. And then he continues with a quote from Psalm 51. Now, Psalm 51, this is kind of significant, is where David is confessing his sins with Bathsheba. Okay? And in that confession, David, who has already been punished for this sin, says to God, and this is the quote, that God was shown to be in the right when he punished David. Okay? He says that God was proved to be in the right when he spoke in judgment against David. The idea, when Paul uses this quote, is that when God judges his unfaithful people, which might look like the covenant's broken, it might look like God has said, oh, you didn't obey me, so instead of blessing you the way I promised, instead, I'm going to punish you. The quote is saying that instead of that kind of a situation, God punishing the people because the covenant is broken, instead, God is punishing, which shows that the covenant is still in force. Okay? Because the covenant had both promises to save and promises to punish sin. And because the covenant promises both salvation and judgment, when God judges sin, either in the case of David with Bathsheba or in the case with the Jews being under the wrath of God here in Romans, because the covenant promises both salvation and judgment, when God judges sin, it proves that he's actually still being faithful to the covenant. And if he's being proved to still be faithful to the covenant, that in turn is proof or demonstration, down payment, that God will then fulfill all the promises of the covenant. Paul was accused of teaching that God had washed his hands of the Jews, that he had adopted the Gentiles instead. And his opponents, who came into the churches and put that argument into Paul's mouth, could then say, but Paul's teaching here makes God unfaithful. And nothing could be more unthinkable than that. Therefore, Paul is wrong. And Paul's saying, no, that's not at all what I teach. God has not abandoned the covenant. He is still faithful to the covenant because the covenant promises that God will punish those who do not obey and then fulfill his promises. Paul doesn't say it real clearly here, but many, many people would say that Paul could have said, and that this is how Paul viewed it, and there's a lot of Old Testament to back this up, that the punishment of those within the covenant is an actual necessary step before the salvation promised by the covenant can come about. Which then leads to the next objection. In verses 5 through 8, again paraphrasing, the objector says, well then, Paul, if this punishment of sin is a necessary step towards the salvation, if our sin gives God the opportunity to show how holy and righteous he is in judging our sin, and if our bad gives God the opportunity to show how good he is in redeeming all of this stuff, that God can actually take the worst situation of the world and turn it around to salvation, aren't we helping him? Good reaction. And if we're helping him to look good, why do we get in trouble for it? And the idea here, and we're chuckling at it, right? But this is really common, okay? It doesn't get articulated this bluntly, but people think this way. The idea is that if our sin is the raw material out of which God works his salvation, why do we get in trouble for just playing our appointed part? And this is such an ungodly way of thinking that Paul actually has to slip in, I'm only speaking in a human way here. Okay? And then he goes on to say that this line of thinking would then lead us to conclude that we should go out and do as much evil as possible so that God can just turn it around to all the more good. And Paul, all that Paul says in response, he doesn't even argue with it. All he says in response is that this is so obviously wicked that we can all see that it's wrong. And you know what? That's actually sometimes a great line of argumentation. When you take what somebody said and you just take it to its natural conclusion, which is so obviously wrong. So, again, many people misunderstood Paul's preaching and still do, or intentionally misconstrued what Paul said and still do. So many reported that this is just what Paul taught and said. There were widespread rumors. Many of the churches that Paul might show up in already thought that Paul taught that the covenant was thrown out, that Israel was nothing anymore, and that we should all do, it doesn't matter what we do, do anything you want because God turns it all around to good. And so Paul, again, needs to clarify what it is that he does and does not teach because he does really need the Roman churches behind him if he's going to succeed in what he plans with Spain. Now this idea, let's do evil because then we are helping God to do good when he turns it around. This is the same kind of reasoning as when people try to argue that Judas is the real hero of the gospel because he's the one that makes the cross possible. Has anyone ever run into that? I have. It's not all that uncommon of an idea. There are modern books. There's this whole line. People in my heresy class know that we've been talking some about Gnosticism, and there's this whole current of neo-Gnosticism where Judas is one of the heroes because he's the one that makes redemption possible, right? If it hadn't been for Judas, Jesus wouldn't have been crucified. It's also the same line of, there's a similar parallel. I once heard a pastor say in a sermon that he didn't really see what the problem with abortion is because we believe that babies go to heaven. And in that case, the congregation was very appropriately shocked because it's so obviously the wrong line of thinking. And all of these examples of similar reasoning, and we could come up with a lot more of them, they're basically all making the same assumption. At the root of them, there's this assumption that God can only judge us on the basis of the final outcome of a situation. That the end justifies the means. That the end justifies everything that happens along the way. That if the story ends well, then we should all just pat each other on the back, regardless of what happened along the way. That if the story ends well, it's a hero story, not a villain story. Okay? But what this kind of thinking ignores is just exactly the point that Paul has been hammering away on. That we are judged by our works. That God judges our choices based on our choices. Regardless of what other facts we try to drag into the picture. If we act selfishly, and God manages to turn it around and do something good with it. And thank God that we really see that happening. Okay? But when that happens, It does not excuse our selfishness. The good ending is to the glory of God and has nothing to do with our destructive behavior. We will still be held accountable. And then, having clarified these two points, Paul then, from verse 9, concludes his argument about the Jew being under God's wrath the way that Paul frequently concludes a lot of his arguments, which is by quoting from the Old Testament, which we have to remember was the only scripture of the day. The New Testament church was born without the New Testament. The New Testament church was a Bible church. The New Testament church was thoroughly grounded in the scriptures, but it was the Old Testament. We have not outgrown it. Another shameless plug for the Old Testament. So, Paul quotes the Old Testament to show that these points that he's making, these things that he's saying about the Jews being under the wrath of God, he's only saying what is completely in line with the Scriptures. He says, "We have made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin." And then there follows a chain of quotes. It's not one big quote. It's a chain of quotes taken mostly from the Psalms and from Isaiah. And in all of them, the sinfulness of people is asserted. Now, it's really interesting to note that this list of quotes falls into three sections that actually, once again, fit a pattern that I hope is becoming familiar. The first section, verses 10 through 12, is about godlessness, about humans turning away from their place of dependence upon God. It says, "There is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away." That's reminiscent of the beginning of the descent into darkness back in chapter 1, right? He's using the same sort of language. He says, "They have together become worthless." You might remember that's a phrase that he used back there about their thoughts have become empty or worthless. "There is no one who does good, not even one." And next, just like we saw in chapter 1 and in chapter 2, this godlessness leads to immorality, which is when people, simply having declared their independence from God, no longer rely upon His judgment of right and wrong, but begin to make their own decisions about right and wrong. And in this case, the emphasis, which so far in chapters 1 and 2 had been on sexual immorality, is now on lying and hateful speech. Verses 13 and 14, "Their throats are open graves, their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips, their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness." This is what turning away from God must lead to, because as soon as we are independent of Him, we begin to make our own decisions about what we think is right and wrong, and that by definition does not line up with what He says is right and wrong, and we suddenly discover that it is not a world where it's all relative, but He is right, we are wrong, we make a lot of good excuses why we think is right is really right, but it is immorality. And this immorality, what seems like simply a personal choice about one's own behavior, "I'm not hurting anybody else," right? "It's my business what I do." What seems like a perfectly legitimate individual choice, in turn, because it is actually immorality, leads to injustice. We think it's all our business, but other people get hurt. Verses 8:15 through 18. "Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. The way of peace," and remember that's this big, big, big important word we talked about a bunch of weeks ago. "They do not know." That way of peace, it's not just how you get along with your neighbor. That way of peace, that's God's vision for what the world is supposed to be. They don't understand what God it is, that what He wants to do. "There is no fear of God before their eyes." And this is that same three-part pattern that we saw in the descent into darkness in chapter 1. It's the same three-part pattern that we saw with Paul's three questions to the Jew. The most basic issue of human sinfulness is godlessness. Rejecting our role as the image of God. Seeking to be independent. The image of ourselves. "I am who I am." No! God alone is "I am who I am." You are who He made you to be.
and we reject that dependence, which is both our highest glory and a place of real subjection. We're not our own image. We're His image. And this godlessness invariably leads to immorality, which is simply nothing other than having our own ideas of right and wrong. And while we like to tell ourselves that our business is just our business, in fact, our immorality will always lead to injustice, to other people being hurt by our choices, and to the beauty, the goodness, and the dignity of God's creation being torn down, being perverted into what it should not be. And like Paul hammered away in chapter 1, when God's daughter, beloved daughter, is taken advantage of, He reacts in wrath. And then Paul anticipates one last objection. Knowing the places that Paul has just quoted from, okay? Most likely here in the room, I know the Old Testament better than anybody, okay? And if I were just reading through this, I would not recognize every single one of these places as, oh, that's Psalm such and such, that's Isaiah, what, this, that's this, this, and know the context of all of these verses. I have the tools, I could track it all down, right? Paul's writing to people that knew the Old Testament the way that we know the Gospel of John and more. When Paul goes through each of these quotes, they know exactly the place he's talking about, and they know the context. They've heard sermon after sermon on these places. And knowing the places from where Paul's taking these verses, the Jew would likely respond, or might respond, ah, but Paul, all those verses are talking about them, the wicked. Okay? You can think of Psalm 1, a familiar one to more of us. It talks about the way of the wicked and the way of the righteous. And we read that and we recognize, we're the righteous, they're the wicked. Yeah, Paul's, yeah, Psalm 1 has all these dire warnings, but not me. Paul, we know those places that you're quoting, and they all talk about them, the wicked, the people outside the covenant. We're God's people. It's not talking about us. And that's why Paul writes in verse 19 something that you can just completely miss, because he doesn't voice the objection. He kind of assumes it. He says, now, we know that what the law says, it says to those under the law. He's saying, you've convinced yourself that the wicked are those outside the covenant. But since the law is speaking to those in the covenant, its warnings for the wicked are warnings for those in the covenant. And since both the just, who will be saved, and the wicked, since both the just who are will be saved and the wicked who are under the wrath of God, since those are both people who are in the covenant, how do you tell? How do you tell who you are? He's putting out to the Jew. Again, and this is he's skipping over a lot because it's a very dense argument, and We're 2,000 years removed. He and his audience are actually much more on the same wavelength, okay? He's saying, if you read the Psalms and you see all these terrifying warnings about the wrath of God coming on the wicked and all these wonderful promises of deliverance coming to the righteous, but if they're all people who are under the covenant, how do you know which one you are? You've jumped too quickly to the assumption that you're the one to be delivered and not the one who's under the wrath of God. Paul's challenging them to take a step back and say, what is my basis to think that I'm not under the wrath of God? And again, Paul's point is the way that you tell is you hold your works up against the law. And he knows that every single person that he's listening to, when they do that, they all have to come to the exact same conclusion. I am not the righteous who can expect deliverance in the day of the Lord. I am the wicked, and I have nothing to expect except the wrath of God. And that's why he concludes, such that every mouth is silenced and the whole world becomes accountable to God. And so then in verse 20, Paul summarizes this entire section, and by the entire section I mean going back to chapter 1, verse 18, all the way up to chapter 3, verse 20. And that summary of this whole section is, therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by observing the law. Because the whole point of the law, there were other things it did as well, but at least here, in the context of what he's saying, the whole point of the law was simply to make people aware of their sinfulness, to bring them in humility to understand that they are under the wrath of God. And if the Jew is under the wrath of God, the Gentile has no hope. But the wrath of God is the beginning of the story. And this is still the beginning of the book of Romans, not the end. Paul wants us to see the dire reality, only that we would then be ready to hear the good news of grace and peace in Jesus Christ.